Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Colin Grant will be joined by three award-winning authors, Chitta Ramaswamy, Ingrid Persaud, and Nicholas Rankin, as they debate on the hierarchies of suffering and whether descending from victims absolves one of responsibility when they begin to act as perpetrators. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival in partnership with Writers Mosaic, this thought-provoking event also launched a new podcast series, What We Leave, We Carry, telling true life stories of pioneering migrants who have come to the UK in the 20th and 21st century.
Thanks for coming. Lovely to see you. So I'm Colin. I'm the director of Writers Mosaic, which is a division of the Royal Literary Fund. And I'm pleased to see that our CEO, Ed, is here today. That's how much importance we impart to this particular event. We're so delighted to be in collaboration with the festival this year, and we hope that will continue throughout the subsequent years. So with me today, I'm going to give a short introduction to my friends and writers, Ingrid Persaud, who's written at least two novels, and sad to say, an award winner, won the Costa First Novel Award a couple of years ago. And Ingrid's going to talk about her new book, The Love Songs of Boys Who Sing. And beside Ingrid, we have my friend Chitra Ramaswamy, who, again, all of the people on the panel are, if I maybe is bold to say, our Writers Mosaic writers. They've all appeared on our website. And Chitra and I have known each other for a few years. And if you want to hear about Homelands, which is the book Chitra is going to be talking about, which is a kind of dual biography with her and Henry Wooger, you can also, after the event, go to our site because Chitra talks about that on the website. And beside Chitra, we have my dear friend, who I've known for at least 25 years, and he has more hair than me, so I don't know what happened there. Nicholas Rankin has written at least six books, and is going to be talking about Trapped in History, which is his new book. And it's a book set mostly in Kenya, although there are moments in Bristol. I'll let Nick talk in more detail about that. And we're going to discuss this idea of memory, what it is that you rely on when you write books, both fiction and non-fiction. How reliable are those memories, and how unreliable are they? And how do you make do when you have no memories? What do you do when there's gaps, absences? So to kick things off, I think I'm just going to ask people just very briefly to describe what the title of their book means. Ingrid.
So my book's The Lost Love Songs of Boys Who Sing, available outside at a very reasonable price. And it refers to the women in Boys Who Sing's life. He was a real-life gangster, lived in the 1940s in Trinidad. And it's lost because these voices... Lost is actually not quite right because they were never inscribed into history. So it's four voices.
Thank you. Chitra?
Yeah, thank you, Colin. My book is called Homelands, The History of a Friendship, and Homelands in the plural, because I really did want to explore the idea of my friendship with this wonderful man called Henry Wooger. He was a Holocaust survivor and Jewish refugee who came to the UK on the Kinder transport. And so I wanted to explore both of our homelands and also a kind of both a personal and a literary investigation and an ethical investigation in a way into why someone like Henry Wooger might be friends with someone like me.
Nicely put. Chitra, Nick?
My book's called Trapped in History, and which is from James Baldwin. These people are trapped in a history which they do not understand, they cannot be free of. And the subtitle is Kenya, Mau Mau and Me. I was a boy in Kenya during the Mau Mau uprising. So this is me as a small boy there. This was a nationalist movement of rebellion, which was crushed with some violence and brutality by the British, for which the British state paid £20 million compensation. You remember Hague 10 years ago, whatever? So it is a complex history of what it is like to grow up in that situation and the effect it has on people afterwards, Africans and Europeans and Asians.
Thanks, Nick. And I forgot to say that I've also written a book. surprise, surprise. My book is called I'm Black, So You Don't Have to Be, which is a comic title. And it refers to the statement that my uncle would tell me time and time again when we were growing up. He was 13 or 14 years older than me. He came from Jamaica to Britain in the year I was born. And as we grew, we became more like brothers rather than uncle and a nephew. But in his mind, he's better looking than me, hard to believe. He's more charming, he's more erudite, he's more learned. But he hasn't had the breaks in life that I've had because he arrived too soon in the culture. He's just considered another irksome darkie. So time and time again, he would say to me, I'm black, Colin, so you don't have to be. So he's done all the heavy lifting for me. One key question, when we write these books, we have to make a decision, don't we, about whether they're going to be fiction or non-fiction. Why did you choose the particular form that you wrote, fiction, non-fiction? You could have written a non-fiction book, couldn't you, on Boise?
I could have written a non-fiction book, but I think that wouldn't have told the sorts of truths that I was interested in, because there are no records beyond the myth-making of someone who was a larger-than-life gangster, a mass murderer, pimp, a gambling king, and he eventually gets executed, if you're worried. So it's
he's nowhere in the vicinity.
He's nowhere in the vicinity. And so I was really curious about the other voices, the voices that are invisible. And so I had no choice. If the voices are invisible, I have only tiny clues to go on. And therefore, I must fictionalize the accounts. Although I don't feel they're fictionalized because they're based on as much information as I can get and as much empathy as I can put into the characters.
And Chitra, you could have written a novel based on this dramatic story. Why choose the nonfiction?
Empathy is a good word that really applies here as well with Homelands, because I knew I couldn't write a conventional biography of Henry because I'm not one of his people and he's not one of my people. And there's no sort of familial or cultural or religious or I even thought at the time, no historical links between us. I thus afterwards changed my mind on that point. So I always knew this book was...
What was the change in mind? What are the historical links?
Well, I think I started off writing this book thinking the sort of kernel at the heart of it lies in our difference. And that is the story. And, you know, Henry, when I met him, was in his 80s. He was just coming to a point where he was learning a huge amount more about his own history, thanks to freedom of information requests and documents that he had accessed from the National Archives. And so he was at a point where he was ready to tell the story. I was at a point where I was ready to tell it. But I didn't know, I just didn't know how to do it. And I think I came to the decision that it would have to be through the lens of our friendship. And that matters hugely to me because it got over the ethical problem of this is not my story to tell. It turned it into a kind of collective story. And I had this idea of, is it possible to write a kind of collective memoir / biography?
Thanks. And Nick, you went to Kenya when you were 3, very important time during the Mau Mau Rebellion. Could have been a very dramatic, I can picture the film there. Why a non-fiction book rather than a fiction?
Well, it's a sort of history / memoir in the sense that you can remember the things that you were there. That's one part of it. But what you saw as a child and what you understood as a child is not what you will find out if you're an adult. So you have to go and look at the history. I'm told certain stories as a boy, and then, you know, certain demonic figures, the Mau Mau, then you go and look at that. You know, look at the documents, look at the other histories, and get another view of the other. So the adult is seeing it differently. Interesting, all the book is nonfiction and trying to be as truthful as possible, but it ends with a short story. The first short story I ever wrote, which was about being a white boy in Kenya during the Mau Mau. And you understand the story having read the rest of the book. But it seemed to me the best place to end was with fiction rather than with, you know, more facts.
Mm. So. Why so? Why the best?
I don't know. There's a different mode or feeling with fiction. I think it's, you know, we know this, those who read novels and those who read history, they are different. And it was a better way of, I don't know, you have to read the story to understand because an action doesn't take place in the story, whereas things do take place in the history. So it's another end.
But sorry, could I just ask, Nick, you say the facts end and then you start the fiction. Do you not think there is fiction insofar as you're interpreting the facts?
Oh, yeah. We've had this argument before. Of course, memoir, history, autobiography, people are shaping the story, not necessarily making things up, but you shape it. Colin uses the word curate at some point. Of course, when you do history, you select certain facts. You can't do everything. You know, it's not like Funes el Memorioso, where he remembers everything he's ever seen. You can't put that in a book, so you have to select. And selection is editing, is censorship, is leaving out.
But we have an interesting moment. Please, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I wonder if you feel the same about this, Nick, that for me, this particular story had to be non-fiction because it had to be a document of the times and of this particular man.
And you show the documents.
That's right. And I wanted the documentation to be in there as well. In other words, like veracity is at the absolute heart of it. And that sense of, you know, recording one man's story and having sort of seeing it in the round. So showing the parts that have also been otherwise invisible, particularly around refugees. We often define them by the journey. And I wanted to look at Henry's life in the round. So it mattered to me hugely that everything in this book was true, you know, with the caveat that it is also, you know, whose truth and how slippery the notion of truth is has to be contained within it as well. I think it's such a difficult thing to do.
So Ingrid, were there few records about Boyce Singh in Trinidad that you could have found to
Very few historical records survived, partly because there was a big fire in Trinidad in the Red House, and that was where all the archives were kept, and they were paper archives. So I...
Who started the fire?
We didn't start the fire. It was always burning. So I am that old. So no archives. So I had to go to what are so-called secondary sources. So I went to newspapers, songs that were written at the time, and, you know, a much maligned source, which is gossip. And I found a great deal of information in gossip simply by talking to people and putting it out there that I'm researching Boyce Singh. And at one point I say to a friend's mum that I'm, you know, doing this research and I'm currently on his wife, Doris. And she says to me, "You don't mean Tanti Doris?" And suddenly there is her truth about remembering Doris. And that, you know, a historian might include as gossip or oral history or something of a very secondary nature. But actually, it was hugely important because it told me what she looked like, that she wore gloves, that she had a hottie chauffeur who always brought her.
A hottie chauffeur?
Well, the old lady could only remember that he was very good looking. And she kept going on. She said, "He was a very good looking." I'm like, "More Doris." She's like, "Ooh, that man, he keeps perfect." So, sort of information I got around it.
Well, it leads to this notion that I often put out that Jamaicans, my parents are Jamaican, Jamaicans say there are no facts, there are only versions. What do we make of that statement?
I have to say that I understand where that's coming from, but there are facts. I wrote a book about the bombing of Guernica. Now, it wasn't the Basques who put petrol in the sewers that blew the town up. Italians and Germans dropped the bombs. These are facts. You know, the fascists intervened in the Spanish Civil War and killed the Basque people. Franco said it wasn't. There was no bombs. We didn't fly. It wasn't us. They did it themselves. The victims killed themselves. We know that. There wasn't us. There are facts. In a detective story, a police story, there are facts. Somebody pulled the trigger. You know, so...
But who put the bullet in the gun?
Yeah, well, there's all that. But there are facts. I understand what you mean about versions and people misremember and they tell stories and they leave things out and we have our own versions of it. But at the end of the day, there are facts.
So you mentioned earlier that historians don't write history, they curate history. So you're a historian. So were you conscious of not wanting to repeat a certain kind of history telling in the construction of your book?
No, I think you just read as much history as you can and newspapers and listen to stories and remember things. So you try and pull it all together and then you make your mosaic out of the bits you've gathered. Now, I try to read as many history books as possible. I mentioned to you, I did another book, a war book, and there was an event and it was in a landing craft. And I have three different accounts of men who were in the same 30-foot landing craft at the same moment, and their versions are completely different. You know, what do? So you put all three versions in, and then the reader is in the chaos of warfare.
Did this come up when you were interviewing Henry?
Massively, because even in the 10 years in which I interviewed Henry, he moved from being in his kind of late 80s to his late 90s. So the same stories. I've never interviewed one person so much in my life. We would, you know, talk about the same episodes in his early life growing up in 1930s Nuremberg. And 5 years later, I would get a different version of that same story. So the problem for the writer there is, do you try and decide with the subject which is the truest one? I decided not to do that and to instead foreground the fallibility of memory itself. So I actually almost had a kind of meta text running through Homelands that was just put me into the room in Giffnock on the south side of Glasgow, where we did most of the interviews in Henry's home, put me into the room with him where I was actually saying, Henry, what happened? And he tells me a story and then he says, I'm sorry I got it wrong. At one moment, he actually said to me, oh, I'm sorry that the last time I told you it was different. I hope I haven't ruined the beginning of your book. And I just thought that in itself is such a beautiful and tender sentiment from a man, you know, in his 90s who survived the Holocaust. Because remember as well, when we're talking about traumatic memories, they are of a different order in terms of memory. And there will be holes and there will be fissures. And I think we need to respect that.
Can you give us a little sample of your writings so the listeners can, and the readers and possible readers can get a sense of why they should buy the book?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to read from a chapter that was about a story Henry told me about going to see his favorite opera in Nuremberg in the 30s, which also happened to be Hitler's favorite opera. When Henry learns that Wagner's opera about Hans Sachs is coming to Nuremberg, he decides to find a way to see it. I said, well, this is an occasion, he tells me with a mischievous grin, rubbing his hands together. I would like to go. Henry shakes his head at the chutzpah of his past self. I was 13. This was Nuremberg in 1937. My mother said, what do you mean? You are not allowed to go. How I got a ticket, I do not know. My mother said I would be beaten to death. I said, no one will know. A little boy? And they didn't. So much of the memory has vanished. Henry can neither recall how he got his hands on a ticket, nor the walk home clutching his libretto, perhaps on air, perhaps already terrified at what had been risked. Gone is the moment of stepping into the exquisite Art Nouveau Opera House on Richard Wagnerplatz, home to the biggest stage in Germany. What's left behind is an opera of the senses, a young heart knocking against a chest in the freighted dark of a theatre, a hard seat against the fidgety legs of a small reactive body, the vertiginous draw of the height, the orchestra tuning in the pit, the heady thrill of getting away with it. Were you frightened? No, says Henry, and we laugh. He's too bloody-minded to be terrified, says Gillian, that's his daughter, and we laugh again. I ask Henry to hold the libretto out in his hand, which is dappled with the hieroglyphs of age, liver spots, veins, creases, errant hairs. There are only words on the libretto's cover, no pictures, and they're conveyed in a medieval romantic font, the kind that conjures up enchanting European fairy tales about princesses letting down their hair and empty turreted castles from a bygone era, the typeface of stories that never die out. I bend over him, holding my phone as steady as my hand will permit. I let the automatic focus do its work, then take a photo, click, the crisp haptic reproduction of a camera lens blinking shut like an eye, the theatre curtain coming down at the end of a performance. How did a Jewish boy come to love the same opera as Hitler? I know, says Henry, making a fist with his hand. It was my fight against Hitler. It's unusual, but that's how it was.
Thank you.
So, Ingrid, have you written an historical fiction? Can it be described thus?
Well, the marketing people are keen to call it historical fiction.
Why do you think that might be the case?
Because of the algorithms. I'm very cynical. I don't, you know, we have to categorize things so that readers are able to access more clearly what they want, but it's just fiction. I call myself a storyteller. And this is just one of the stories that I tell, and it happens to be based in the past rather than contemporary.
So what's the responsibility of that kind of storyteller? I preface that by saying that I've heard some stories about people at university now studying history, and when they want to learn about Thomas More or Thomas Cromwell, they go to Wolfe Hall, Hilary Mantel's Wolfe Hall. Is there any danger that we go to the wrong sources when we want to get to the truth of history? Can we all jump in on that?
Well, they're great. Trevelyan, G.M. Trevelyan, historian, praised Robert Louis Stevenson's novel, The Black Arrow, because he said it teaches history in the best sense. It takes people back to the mentality of that time. I think historical fiction's, you know, useful. A lot of us, most of the history we know is probably from films and novels. What I know about the French Revolution probably comes from A Tale of Two Cities and, you know, all those other stories. I don't know. I don't think it's wrong to in any way. I think the historical fiction writers that I know really do their research, as did Hilary Mantel. So I don't have a problem with it, but it isn't history. You know, if you've read Invented Characters and stuff. But, you know, take the Flashman books. If anyone read the Flashman books, he invented this character. He was the bully in Tom Brown's school days. And he gave this man a life of Victorian adventure, chasing women and fighting in battles. They're good history. They're novels. But they still, you learn a lot about 19th century history. I have no problem with it.
I have no problem with it either. But I think what's happening now, which is really, really welcome, is that history is being reappraised. And it's so long overdue, isn't it? So I think previously we maybe went to fiction for the likes of, you know, hearing about these women who have never been examined in history. In fact, they've been completely obscured and written out by history. So I think things are maybe changing a little bit now because the narratives are being seized. And so they should be. And the time has come for people to tell their own stories and for history to acknowledge them more. So perhaps those differences, it will become a more porous space.
But I think that the danger, which is hinted at in Colin's question, is about going to one source. So when there's a huge movie about a character like JFK, if the only source that we are getting is the movie of JFK, then that is a real difficulty for us. So I think it's about complementary sources rather than, you know, going to one.
Yeah. History isn't one thing. I think this idea, history is continually being reassessed. It's not history unless it's turned over. Every generation rewrites the history. Yeah, I think it's continually being turned over.
Mm-hmm. Would it be difficult for you to go into the acquisitions meeting for your second book and to say, no, I don't want to write a novel. I want to write a non-fiction book on Boise Sing. Would they have told you not to slam the door on the way out?
Nah, they like me. No, I think they would have hesitated and said that perhaps the material was too limited.
Okay.
I think, you know, because I don't write big swashbuckling books that romanticize violence and particularly gender-based violence. So that's not me.
But it's an important question about who gets to tell the story, isn't it? I mean, increasingly one thinks about, oh, the phrase pops up again and again, I don't have the right to tell this story. Who does have the right to tell the story? I remember being asked about the most important black book of black history, of black presence in Britain a few years ago. And I said, oh, without a doubt, it's Peter Fryer's Staying Power. Now, unfortunately, Peter Fryer is white, and a Marxist historian, but he's still written a bloody great book. And it's because he said he was going to think black. So he was going to put himself in a black person's shoes, and he's going to be empathic. So it doesn't matter that you don't so-called belong to the culture in which you're writing about.
I think it both does and it doesn't. It depends who's doing it, what are the power relations and for what reasons, what's motivating you. It definitely was the biggest question for me because, you know, I began from a place of I'm not Jewish, I'm not a historian, I don't speak Hebrew, my history's not European. Really, why me? And I suppose the most obvious answer to that question is that Henry gave his story to me. He gave me permission. No one else was going to write it. He was part of the last generation of Holocaust survivors. So the urgency of telling these stories is paramount. And so I started to think that actually in this moment of deep polarization and division, is there a way that telling other people's stories could almost become an act of empathy?
And you do it. You've done it brilliantly.
Well, thank you. But the grappling with that question also has to become part of the story, because I do think we need to be careful about those power dynamics, and it depends what direction they're going in, you know?
But we mustn't be frightened of what other people think, okay? They're terrified. You can't go there. This is called appropriation, and you know, people are being frightened into one thing. I don't think you should stick in your lane if you don't want to. If you're a writer, you are free to write. And you were free to, of course, it was difficult to write about Henry Wooger. But the fact, the hybrid vigor of your two different cultures and perspectives working together works brilliantly. It didn't have to be another Jewish male person to write his book. It was somebody from outside who had the sympathy and could go into the whole history of how the you know, the internment of 1940, the Italians, the Germans, the Jews, people, anti-Nazis, these people were all locked up. Some died on the Arandora Star. A load of Italians, waiters, picked up in London. And that was torpedoed, the ship. Then they all went to the Isle of Wight. There was a great university on the Isle of, not the Isle of Wight, the Isle of Man. And then they got reduced to Category C and they got freed. But there was a great injustice done, as the Americans did with the Japanese. They locked them all up after Pearl Harbor. This has always gone on in history.
So, Nick, here you are. You're in favour. Your publisher are in favour. What are the kind of conversations about whether you should be writing this book at this time?
Was it an easy sell?
Did you get an easy path into publication?
I'm afraid I broke the rules. I was meant to write another
book.
Right. And I didn't do it. I said, can you do this one instead? Okay.
But you address some of the issues that we're talking about in your introduction. That's what I'm trying to get at.
The issue is difficult. I mean, this is a subject, okay, a white person writing black history, essentially. If you look at the pictures of this is African history, okay, about a nationalist uprising in Kenya, the first important armed uprising in Africa for liberation, before Frelimo, before Zimbabwe, before all those, is the Mau Mau. And the Mau Mau were demonized greatly. If people of an older generation remember the stories, the myths, everything about Mau Mau, this was terrifying to people. So to look at this subject, to write about this subject, is difficult. It's you're looking at trauma, you're looking at a civil war within the Kikuyu, partly as well as all kinds of oppressions of the hierarchy. You know, it was an apartheid society. I described it to Ingrid like a great pyramid. You have 50,000 Europeans at the top. You have 250,000 Asians, Indians and Pakistanis in the middle. And then you have nearly 6 million Africans underneath. This is a pyramid that is going to explode. And it did explode in 1952.
And you have a little white boy there as well.
Well, you know, you're there as an... The opening of the sentence of the book is, we only went to Africa because a businessman fumbled in his jacket pocket. His car keys snagged the trigger of his Beretta and he shot himself in the stomach. My father got his job. So a casual act of accidental violence changes my entire life.
Give us a little flavor of the book, a little tiny little flavor.
Okay, I'll give you a flavor of the book. There's a chapter called The Sounds of Time, and this was a record. I don't know if anyone knows this record. It was an amazing record drawn from BBC archives of historical recordings from about 1930 to 1945. And I love that record. it was actually my future, because what it was a feature program. It had all this actuality. Colin and I worked in the radio together, making programs with the sounds of recorded voices. And what I can't tell you, I cannot say how many times I listened to The Sounds of Time as a boy, but I learned bits of it by heart, imitating the voices and their accents at different crises. The Hindenburg. It's burst into flames and it's crashing. The Abdication. For the sake of the woman I love. Chamberlain in 1939. And that consequently this country is now at war with Germany. The Cockney Blitz. I bet Hitler's mother and father weren't married. Colonel Britain. The night is your friend. The V is your sign. Lord Haw-Haw. Germany calling. Germany calling. Himmler's suicide. We threw a blanket over him and left him. The war came to us because we all lived in the shadow of the Second World War. I'm born in 1950. We grew up in the aftermath of the war. The war, not the dirty war in the Kenya colony we were living through, but the Second World War that overshadowed us all, came home to me with a visceral shock via an Imperial Octavo-sized red and black book, which was published by the Daily Mail in 1945. I found it one day when I was crawling around my father's study looking for things I wasn't supposed to see. I must have been 8 or 9. There was a slim volume low down on the left side of the shelves of the wall opposite the window. Spiky black barbed wire ran diagonally across the red cover of the book, which was called Lest We Forget. I opened it to find the subtitle inside. The Horrors of Nazi Concentration Camps, Revealed for All Time in the Most Terrible Photographs Ever Published. There was a map of Germany with the ugly names of camps in white letters and black boxes: Wibelin, Neuengamme, Ravensbrück, Sachsenhausen, Oranienburg, Belsen, Nordhausen, Buchenwald, Mauthausen, and so on and so on. Black and white photographs show a squalid, muddy camp with humps of old blankets and a caption from Dante: All hope abandoned, ye who enter here. Racked bunks of skeletal prisoners. Women peeling potatoes next to dead bodies. A fleshless man picking lice from rags. Dead children. Corpses in straw. Filth. Piles of empty boots, and so on. The death pit at Belsen. All tangled naked limbs. Truckloads of corpses. German guards and civilians clearing heaps of dead bodies at gunpoint. The pictures had a terrible fascination. Susan Sontag would call it negative epiphany. They were disgusting, but I couldn't really look away. They drew me in like pornography, but they did not produce erotic excitement, just a kind of dull, choking horror, like the way you close down senses and try not to breathe when confronting a charnel stench like the appalling abattoir of Addis Ababa I once encountered. Looking at those pictures, even as a child, I knew this was real. Years later, as an adult journalist, I would sit in the photography annex of the Imperial War Museum in London, looking at the original pictures from Belsen and reading the dope sheets of the British war photographers who took them. It happened. They were there. They witnessed what racial thinking led to, how people from the heart of European civilization murdered millions of other humans they considered inferior, subhuman, untermenschen. We were told how terrible the Black Mau Mau were. But the white master race, with its Nazi ideology, was unbeatable in the business of atrocity, murder, and genocide. What I could not conceive, as I sat on the floor of my father's study in my shorts and shirt and barter sandals, was that we, the brave British who I knew had won the war and defeated the baddies, were now building our own kind of concentration camps with barbed wire and watchtowers all around me in colonial Kenya.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. So I'm going to try to be democratic. We're going to have some questions from the floor soon, but I want to get a flavour of your book, Ingrid, because Boise Singh was also a kind of bogeyman, wasn't he? Wasn't he kind of a scary character that you warned about as a child?
So my parents would say, you know, you're not going to eat your cereal. Boise Singh going to come and get you. And then later as a teenager, you're going out late. Boise Singh going to come and get you. Anyway, so there was Boise Singh always coming to get you. I'm conscious of time, so I'm just going to read the first page of the book, and it looks like this. And it is entirely made up, but it looks like a historical document. I've copied the fonts exactly and the layout from a newspaper.
Of what time?
Of 1957. So this is appropriation upon appropriation.
Not in my life.
The Trinidad Monitor, Port of Spain, Trinidad, British West Indies, February 23rd, August 1957. The End of Boise by Gerard Max Davidson, staff reporter. Knowing the end was coming, John Boise Singh, the Raja, who once controlled illegal activities in Port of Spain and in the Gulf of Paria, said, "I have lived, I have seen things, and I have done things. Now I must go, but I am innocent of this crime. I always tried to help people, and that is how I got a great deal of my troubles. That is what has me here now." He asked to go first, but on 20th August 1957 was made to wait an hour until 8 o'clock after Bolan Ramkisoon's body was cut down and laid aside. A Catholic priest, Father Tiernan, who asked for his name not to be reported, walked him to the gallows. Wearing prison-issue white cotton pajamas, the Raja met death chanting, "My Jesus, mercy, my Jesus, mercy, my Jesus, mercy." As prescribed, the hangman was paid $77 per man for his duties. A Gregorio Brothers van took the body from the jail to the General Hospital and then to St. James Cemetery, where Boise was laid to rest in a crude white pine unpainted coffin, his name written on top in chalk. None of his close relatives, seen visiting the condemned man in the days leading up to the hanging, were present at the graveside.
Thank you. Great, thanks very much. So we've just got 10 minutes, and so I'd like to invite anyone who'd like to pose a question to this esteemed panel. Does anybody have an idea, a question they'd like to pose? Any thoughts, reflections? Whilst you're thinking, I'll ask another question.
Well, actually, I wanted to say something.
Okay,
I looked at my phone while Nick was speaking.
How rude.
I know. It was terrible.
I understand all too well. I would the same.
And the reason I did is because I wanted, because my memory is so bad, and I wanted to look up the name of a book, and it's called American Dirt. And you can look it up. And it was on your point about staying in your lane, you know, because this was a highly controversial case where she gets paid $1 million to write a book, and the community of writers says, well, why her story about crossing the border from Mexico into, you know, the US, and when they're all of us who've been struggling and writing and experiencing this firsthand, why does she, a privileged person who's never done this, doesn't speak enough Spanish, etc. So there are real problems in it, and people like her and American Dirt make it a difficult debate. So I'm all for being open, but I think that there needs to be some sense of responsibility if you go into someone else's lane. You know, you can dip in their ink, but make sure you understand what you're doing.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I think you should try. You should be responsible and you should cite your sources. Should I not have written this?
Oh, no. You were a little white boy experiencing it. I want to know your story.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. This is your story too. It belongs to you. But it's important, isn't it? I also think in your example, Ingrid, of American Dirt, I really remember that scandal. And I think it was a scandal. And I think part of it is also when you are going into lanes where the people who to whom those stories happened haven't yet had the chance to tell them. So that's also key. You know, with Holocaust literature, I mean, it's a huge, huge literature, but no one like me has told a story about someone like Henry. So that's both a kind of dangerous and risk-laden prospect, But there's also something in it in terms of collective responsibility and shared history.
Well, your book is a far better book than those books of people who pretended they were in the Holocaust and never were. There'd been two or three famous people exposed for bullshitting about it. So books get published and, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean they're good books. They might get a lot of publicity. It doesn't make them a good book.
Absolutely.
This is the difficulty. I know this story. It was the migrant train, wasn't it, up this American dirt story. And she was criticized because what? She had never been there, knew nothing about it, and had just thought this is a good story. Is that right?
She also did, you know, it's a bit tacky and tasteless. We don't need to go into it. Don't buy the book, okay? That would be but I think what's coming through in the discussion, though, is two words come to mind: responsibility and empathy. And I think when those two things are at play in the writing, then, you know, you may not write the perfect story, but you're writing with the best of intentions.
You do your best. I mean, you're going to fail. Nearly all books are failures in one way or another. We have to admit.
Speak for yourself, young man.
Yeah, I do. I do.
I know yourself here.
But, you know, because you have this dream when you set out, there's this wonderful vision. And can you achieve it? Never quite, man.
But that's the joy, isn't it? To reach for it and to try to grasp it and fail. The man in the blue top there. You wanted to pose a question?
Just had a question about Chip. You said that nobody like you had ever told that story before. I just wondered, you know, what do you think that you brought to it, your own kind of life story, your own narrative?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really great question. I think what I, again, it goes back to what I was saying right at the start of the event about how I started off thinking that we were sort of poles apart, and that was the kind of beauty of the story lay in our difference. And I came to a different conclusion by the end, and that was about a kind of commonality of experience and a sort of shared perspective, really, that came from, in Henry's case, growing up in a kind of progressive middle-class Jewish family, and that my family had grown up in South India and as a kind of middle-class South Asian Hindus, and that there were huge kind of cultural sensibilities that we shared. So that was like a kind of personal level about our two families, and just that very sort of strange thing of sometimes you might meet someone and they just feel like family. But at a kind of wider historical level, I started to look at the relationship between India gaining independence and how massively that was accelerated by the Second World War, and about, you know, how many Indians fought in the army, and to understand these these connections that I had never learned about in school. And I think the problem that sometimes happens when we all stay in our own lanes, there are very good reasons for doing so, is that, you know, huge areas of history get kind of written out, or we don't get to know them. For example, I started to learn so much about the anti-colonialist movement that was, you know, the way the white working classes in Britain identified with the struggles that were going on in India, for example. I remember like studying at university post-colonial literature, and I'm like, where's the anti-colonial literature, you know? Why isn't anti-colonialism studied? Because those are stories of solidarity, and I think we need to hear them now more than ever.
Thank you. Before we've got room for one more question, anybody want to pose a question whilst we're up? Staying in your lane is a very tricky concept. I remember when I wrote my first book, I wrote a book about this man called Marcus Garvey, Marcus Messiah Garvey, and the book is called Negro with a Hat. It's my first book. I'm very excited, and I got an interview with BBC Birmingham. I live in Brighton. It was one of those phone-in programs, and the presenter is a priest, is a reverend, and he's very nice, and he's taking questions, and the first question comes up, and I know it's a Jamaican, because it's not a question, it's a statement. The guy says, I resent the fact that the publisher got a white man to write a book about Marcus Garvey. And I said, what makes you think I'm white? And he said, you don't sound black. So there was this conception that I'm some sort of wannabe white man, middle class, and I'm in the wrong lane as well, actually. So we have to question who is in the right lane, I think. Well, I think we're going to draw this to an end. Thank you for coming. You will be delighted to hear that there are some copies of these wonderful writers' books outside, which are informative, educational, and they're entertaining. But for now, can I ask you to thank Ingrid Persaud, Chitra Ramaswamy, Nicholas Rankin, and do check out
and
our...
And Colin Grant.
And do check out our website. It's called Writers Mosaic. There's the one word there. And as I said, we're a division of the Royal Literary Fund, which has been going since 1790 to support writers. Sometimes they get them out of debtor's jail because writing doesn't make any money for anybody. And they continue to do so. They give out grants every year. It's a wonderful site. They've got a new, wonderful, shiny website themselves. We're part of that. Check us both out. Writers Mosaic, the Royal Literary Fund. Thank you very much, Bradford.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.